MacCast, Sunday, May 17th, 2020. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I am super glad to be back here with you after kind of an unexpected hiatus. I know it's strange times we're living in right now, and hopefully you are doing fine and well. Things are going okay for me. It's just as is for a lot of us, chaotic with life and things happening, but I have to tell you, we got some great Mac and Apple news and things to get into in this episode. So I'm super excited to be back talking with you, hoping to hear from you on some of these topics. Things that we're going to be talking about in this episode include Apple's second quarter earnings. Yeah, they announced those way back when, a couple weeks ago, I guess, now at this point. We also have lots of news in the form of Apple TV Plus announcements, so we'll run down all of those. We got an updated Mac over the last week or so, a new 13-inch MacBook Pro. We're going to talk about the specs there and some thoughts and opinions, and also what might be next for the MacBook Pro. We'll get into some AirPod issues, also take a look at what might be happening with iPads later this year, updates to Apple Watch, and of course, you have all the latest iPhone 12 information, and we'll get into that in this episode. And then we're going to go back and talk a little bit more, get some of your reactions on Apple TV Plus and programmings. I got a great comment from a listener this week. I have a tip for you on something you can do pretty neat with your Apple TV that I was unaware of, a little tip sent in by a listener, or pointed out to me by a listener and written up over at Tidbits. We'll get into that. Also, I have a new Mac in my life. I'll let you know what that is, why it happened, and what I think about it. And then I had a question about board games on iPads. And I pulled in a friend of mine and we talked about some great tabletop versions of tabletop games on iOS. So we're going to get into all of that in this episode. Should be a lot of fun. Stay tuned. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is CashFly. We love CashFly here at the MacCast because they make it possible for you to hear this episode. Yeah, they deliver the MacCast to you, so you wouldn't be hearing this right now without CashFly. They make sure these episodes get out quickly and reliably, and they also want to help you do that for your website and your business. Specifically, when websites don't load quickly, people lose interest. As a matter of fact, for each second a page takes to load, it costs a company about 16% in engagement. And fewer visits means fewer customers, and that's not good for anyone. CashFly has your back, though, with their new web optimization capabilities. All of your content can be optimized before it is delivered to your visitors without ever requiring any development effort from you. And with the recent addition of CashFly's Flexible Edge application program and implementation services, their capabilities reach far beyond those of any traditional CDN. CashFly's web content optimization solution includes powerful APIs for solving content distribution problems, on-the-fly next-generation image optimization, application load balancing, and smart asset delivery. Listen, if your website is directly tied to your revenue, and you know it is, optimize your site content now. Guarantee the best user experience for all of your customers, no matter where they are or what device they're using. And best of all, the good people at CashFly are even going to provide a free optimization consultation for listeners of this podcast. That's right, just for you. Know exactly where your site stands today with a Lighthouse score report and learn how CashFly's web optimization solution can help add 60 points instantly to your score. Visit mac.cashfly.com, that's mac.cachefly.com, to get that Lighthouse score report and learn how CashFly's web optimization solution can help you. And a big thank you to CashFly for their support of the show. Let's get into Apple's earnings for the last quarter. They did have their second quarter announcement, and they ever so slightly beat the numbers from the same quarter last year, which in light of events, of course, you know, this is not covering all of the events recently, but that's not too shabby. Revenue of $58.3 billion and profit of $11.25 billion in the second quarter of 2020. That's versus $58 billion in revenue and $11.56 billion in profit for the same quarter in 2019. Tim Cook credited the increases in strong results for services and wearables revenue, helping maintain growth in the quarter. Services revenue was actually at an all-time record of $13.35 billion for the quarter, and wearables hit a quarterly revenue record of $6.28 billion. For the other categories, Apple saw a little bit of decline, $28.96 billion for iPhone, down from $31 billion in the year-ago quarter, $5.4 billion for Mac, that was down from $5.5 billion, and $4.4 billion for iPad, down from $4.9 billion. Overall, not too bad, though, all things considered. Now, other notes of interest include that Apple had gross margin for services of 65.4%, so those services growing and also very, very profitable for the company. Third-party subscriptions grew over 40% year over year, another great source of revenue for Apple services. And Apple now has 515 million paid subscribers across all of their services. Unfortunately, they did not break it down by service because I'd be really interested to actually know those numbers. They did mention, though, that Apple News now has 125 million monthly users. Again, though, they didn't break out how many of those users are actually paid subscribers to the service. Tim Cook expects to reach the company's goal of doubling their 2016 services revenue sometime in this year with all of that growth. It's not surprising that they are going to make that target. And also, perhaps not surprisingly, Sensor Tower reported that for the first time, downloads of paid iPad apps went above 1.1 billion, showing the first year-over-year growth since the fourth quarter of 2013. And that's probably not surprising because it's a little bit of a sign of the times. A lot of people are home, a lot of people are looking for things to do, and downloading apps on iPad would likely be something we'd be doing. And as a matter of fact, the top two categories in that report were entertainment and games, followed by education apps, because a lot of folks are educating at home now since we can't be heading out to school. Also, consumer spending on apps showed the largest year-over-year increases since the fourth quarter of 2014 and went above $2 billion for the first time ever. So overall, a pretty strong, good quarter for Apple. They did kind of give some advisement that the next quarter numbers might not be so rosy, but we'll have to wait and see how Apple has things pan out for the next quarter. But at least for the second quarter, they did surprisingly well. A lot of new names and shows coming to Apple TV, along with current faces. Apple made a two-year content creation deal with writer and producer Annie Wiseman. Wiseman, already executive producer of the upcoming TV show Physical on Apple. This new contract broadens her relationship with Apple and will see her develop other exclusive content and television shows for Apple. Also, the morning show showrunner, Carrie Aaron, also agreed to extend the contract with Apple. According to Variety, the deal is a new multi-year extension, which will see her developing exclusive projects for Apple TV+. Apple also hired the BBC's factual controller, Allison Kirkham, expanding their original content division in the UK. Kirkham will join Apple TV Plus this summer as head of development for Apple's European unscripted series and movies. At the BBC, Kirkham led the award-winning documentary productions Planet Earth 2 and Blue Planet 2. Also, Apple set an overall deal with Alina Smith, the showrunner for Dickinson. So they are vastly expanding the number of folks that are producing original content for them. As far as actual new content we might see come to Apple TV+, Variety is reporting that Apple has acquired the rights to Ewan McGregor's Long Way Up motorcycle travel series. Apple TV+ also announced a new documentary film, Dads, which will be available on June 19th on the service. Obviously timed to coincide with Father's Day on June 21st, It's an 80-minute documentary film from Bryce Dallas Howard, daughter of filmmaker and actor Ron Howard, who, not surprisingly, is appearing in the film. The film mixes interviews with folks from everyday life, along with celebrities exploring the modern-day definition of being a father. This is the first Apple TV Plus project to come from Apple's deal with Imagine Entertainment, which is Brian Grazer and Ron Howard's production company. Sofia Coppola is going to adapt the 1913 novel Custom of the Country by Edith Wharton into a new series for Apple TV+. Coppola is well known for her films, but this will be the first time she has done a TV series. Coppola is also working on a movie for Apple TV+ called On the Rocks, starring Bill Murray and Rashida Jones. It's still not clear what's going to happen with Apple TV Plus as the second season comes around for many of their new series, as production has halted on a lot of those services. But in the meantime, the cast of Mythic Quest has actually shot a special quarantine episode that is set to debut on Apple TV Plus on May 22nd. The episode will be ripped from real life, with the employees of the fictional company dealing with video game development while working from home. The episode was all shot on iPhone and was reportedly produced in just a few days. I have really enjoyed Mythic Quest, the series on Apple TV+, and I am looking forward to this little special on May 22nd. So lots of things happening on the Apple TV+ front. Obviously, I think there is going to be somewhat of a lull as a lot of production has not been able to ramp up on second season or has been halted on some of the continuing seasons. It's going to be interesting to see how Apple's going to handle this. We talked about this a little bit on our episode with Ken Ray and Victor Cajiao, the Three Amigos episode. I hadn't really thought about it until Ken brought it up, but it'll be interesting to see. One of the theories he had was that Apple might have to extend its free trial, considering that they had really kind of timed it from a marketing standpoint to end right about the time the second seasons of a lot of these shows were starting up, and that would incentivize people who are on the free trials to continue with their subscriptions. So we'll have to wait and see how Apple reacts and what they actually do, but I'd be curious to get your opinions on this. Do you think this is going to cause a problem for them, or do you think they'll be able to kind of wade through it? Let us know, maccast@gmail.com. Apple did release some new hardware recently. As expected, we got an update to the 13-inch MacBook Pro. As not expected, though, they did not change the screen size. Apple released the updated 13-inch MacBook Pro with the new updated Scissor Switch Magic Keyboard. A lot of people very excited about that. The updated MacBook Pro features a new faster 10th generation Intel processor option, faster GPUs using Intel's latest Iris Plus integrated graphics, up to 32 gigabytes of RAM, and up to 4 terabytes of SSD. The entry level of the lineup does still use the 8th generation Intel processors, and as mentioned, the screen remains unchanged from the previous model. Early benchmarks do show that the 10th generation processors deliver about a 15% performance increase over the previous model. So, you know, that's nice, but it does show that those 8th gen processors are still pretty darn good. The storage has also been doubled across the line from the previous generation, with the base models now having 256 gigabyte SSDs. That's a nice bump up, because I always felt that 128 was a little bit paltry on the bottom end. I still think 256 is kind of hard to live with, at least for me. I prefer to have about a terabyte, and for me, 512 seems like the absolute bottom limit. I know a lot of people do complain about the sizes of SSDs and them not being quite large enough, although with iCloud storage and other options, it's becoming, I think, a little bit of less of an issue. I don't know how you feel about that. All of these new models do come with a touch bar and a physical escape key, along with the inverted T orientation of the arrow keys, something that a lot of people are very happy about. The lower end models feature two Thunderbolt 3 ports, and the highest end models do now have four Thunderbolt 3 ports. They all feature 802.11 AC Wi-Fi, which was a little bit surprising that they haven't bumped the machines up to the new Wi-Fi 6, and they also all come with Bluetooth 5.0. In addition, they all have Dolby Atmos playback and the new enhanced 3-mic array built-in microphones with directional beamforming, just like on the 16-inch model. The model with the four Thunderbolt ports is capable of driving an Apple Pro Display XDR at its full 6K resolution. The lower-end model is limited to the 4K, 5K display options. And all of that being awesome, it is a little bit disappointing that these models still feature the 720p FaceTime camera. I don't know why Apple has not updated the FaceTime cameras to 1080 HD cameras. It is frankly baffling in this day and age. I know a lot of people to do video conferencing and get better video, especially for doing say streaming, Twitch, YouTube videos and stuff like that, they often resort to third-party cameras, having to buy those. And it is one of those areas where Apple chooses to save costs, but I can't imagine that those cameras are that much more expensive. So hopefully someday we'll get 1080p FaceTime cameras, but at least not with this new updated 13-inch MacBook Pro model. As far as pricing starts at $1,299 US for the quad-core 8th generation Intel Core i5 model running at 1.4 gigahertz with 8 gigs of RAM and a 256 gigabyte SSD. If you want to jump up to the higher end base configuration, that comes in at $1,799 US, features a 10th generation quad-core Intel Core i7 processor running at 2 gigahertz with 16 gigabytes of RAM and a 512 gigabyte SSD. So nice little bump up to the lineup. I think the biggest thing here is the move to that scissor switch keyboard, and a lot of people are very excited about this new model MacBook Pro. We did have a rumor for a while, though, that Apple might be doing a 14.1-inch Retina MacBook Pro in 2020. This didn't turn out to be it. We know from Ming-Chi Kuo and others that Apple has been looking into mini LED displays. We've talked about that a little bit here on the MacCast. He's been discussing the possibility of those mini LED updates coming to iPads and MacBook Pros. We thought it might happen this year, but since that didn't happen, it's now expected that we might see a 14-inch mini LED MacBook Pro sometime in early 2021, maybe an update to this new model here. There are also hints that Apple may revive the 12-inch MacBook Pro next year, and that could get that display. It's also rumored that that model might be Apple's first ARM-based Mac with their own processor design, and that would be pretty cool. We are expecting Apple to do that, and it does make sense that they might start with a MacBook model. So we'll have to wait and see on that one. But for now, really nice bump up update in the MacBook Pro lineup. Apple has made some steps to address some issues being reported by AirPods Pro users. The users report issues of crackling and noise cancellation problems. Apple did release a recent firmware update to address those issues and also offered some advice and possible remedies. They said make sure that your Mac and iOS software is up to date. Also make sure that the latest AirPods Pro firmware is installed. That should actually happen automatically on your AirPods. Also double check any issues with specific audio applications. So if you experience problems in one, they advise opening up a different application and making sure it isn't isolated to the software itself. They also mentioned that noise cancellation performance can be impacted if the mesh in your AirPods Pro gets gummed up with earwax or other debris. So they advise cleaning your AirPods Pro, especially if you've noticed reduced bass response or more background noise when the noise cancellation feature is enabled. Obviously, if you've checked all those things and you've updated your firmware and your issues are still persisting, Apple says you should contact Apple support and they can help you out. Also on the headphone front, we've got a little bit more information on Apple's rumored branded over-the-ear headphones. And what we're hearing now is that they may have head and neck detection built into them. Sources told 9to5 Mac that the Apple AirPods Studios, as they're being referred to, would detect when the wearer has them on their head versus when they've taken them off and put them around their neck. And doing so would activate pausing or resuming of music playback accordingly. This would simulate or be similar to the feature of AirPods Pros and AirPods, which have in-ear detection and can detect when you take them out of your ear and pause your music. Obviously, with a set of over-the-ear headphones, they're going to have to do it another way, and it sounds like they might be using some sort of sensors or detection. I don't know if they'd just be built into the ear cups or maybe into the actual headband, but it'll be interesting to see how they've implemented that. But it should detect that and react accordingly. There's also reports of another sensor that will detect left and right ears and route the audio channels accordingly. So that would mean it wouldn't matter which side you put the ear cups on. You could put them on either way, and it would know which is your right ear and which is your left ear, which is pretty cool. If you've ever had headphones that have kind of a little, you know, right letter on them, sometimes those are not always obvious or easy to see. Ola AirPods Pro or AirPods, they've got that tiny little mark, although I can pretty much well detect with the AirPods Pro because of their shape which ear it's supposed to go in. They feel really odd and uncomfortable if you have them in the wrong ears. But cool that you might have a set of headphones that can just automatically detect and adapt to that, and so very Apple-like to do that sort of thing. It's also being reported that the device will unlock a custom equalizer setting, allowing you to control low, medium, and high frequency adjustments. It's also believed they will offer active noise cancellation technology and transparency mode, just like the current AirPods Pro. And in previous shows, we also discussed the fact that they might have interchangeable materials that use magnets to swap out various pieces to adjust the style and usage. Leather, for example, for say like a more high-end studio look, and plastics or more breathable materials for maybe when you're working out, as an example. And as far as when the new headphones will be announced, we're expecting them sometime in 2020. Not really sure, but it'd be nice to see Apple do some over-the-ear headphones. Of course, there's still that speculation or question, will those compete with Apple's Beats brands? Although we've seen them competing with AirPods Pro and some of the Beats in-ear headphones as well, so that hasn't turned out to be a problem. I think they likely could sell kind of both designs, and I don't know, you know, do they have separate markets for those? It feels like Beats kind of sell to a different demographic than maybe some of the Apple products, but maybe that's just me. Let me know what you think. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Looking forward to later in 2020, Ming-Chi Kuo has some new speculation and predictions about what the next iPads might look like. Ming-Chi Kuo says that Apple will launch a new 10.8-inch iPad during the second half of 2020, followed by a new iPad mini that's somewhere between 8.5 inches and 9 inches during the first half of 2021. This is intended to be a new entry-level system, according to reports, and will take on the same strategy that Apple has been taking with some of its other products, like the iPhone 11 with the iPhone SE. Offering the latest in custom Apple A-series processors along with a more affordable price tag. Well, maybe not the newest, but newer. We're hearing that this rumored 10.8-inch model would have an A12 Bionic chip, which is what is already in the iPad mini and the iPad Air. Quick aside on something that I read about recently over at Android Central relating to Apple's choice to take their higher-end processors and include them in their lower-cost devices. Jerry Hillebrand pointed out that the lowest-cost iPhones now have processors with single-core performance that beat out or perform better than the highest end flagship Android models that cost a lot more. And it's not even just because of the A13 processor. He also pointed out that the iPhone 8's single core threaded performance also beats out Android's top flagship phones, and that's because Apple's processors are an amazing combination of hardware technology and software technology, and they are loading them into their devices across the board. So they're not kind of going with lower-end processors for their low-end devices and something different for their higher-end devices, and that really gives them kind of a performance edge. So seeing them take this trend and move it also into iPads is really not surprising. And I have a feeling we'll see this continue when they start to do their own processors for their Mac lineup. So they differentiate the products in a different way, you know, doing things like saving costs on maybe the camera. So you get a 2-lens camera instead of a 3-lens camera, kind of keeping other high-end features like the LiDAR sensors and those sorts of things to make that differentiation. But they're using the same underlying processor technology, which gives you kind of a level playing field across the lineup. And another great benefit of that, I think, is that it's an advantage for developers. It makes software development and being able to use the latest and greatest stuff much easier, because you don't have to kind of adapt for the lower end devices or the higher end devices. You can know that you have access to all the tools and all the performance on the last few generations of devices. And I think that's a real advantage for Apple and something that I hadn't really thought about. Moving back to that 10.8-inch iPad, it's not clear if this would be a replacement for the low-cost 10.2-inch iPad coming in at $329 US, or if it would be an update to the 10.5-inch iPad Air. I kind of feel like it's the former rather than the latter, which is pretty cool, and I also have a feeling that we could see the 10.8-inch model be the final merging of the low-cost iPad and the iPad Air into a single model in the lineup, but that's just my own speculation. Pushing the iPad mini's display up from 7.9 inches to 9 inches, I think, is also interesting. It does follow Apple's trend toward larger displays with possibly reduced bezels. They don't comment on the fact that will the form factor stay the same, but you'll just get a larger screen. It probably would have to size up a little bit, I think, to cram in a 9-inch display. Maybe they could get away with the 8.5-inch. We'll have to wait and see, but you're starting to push that Mac mini, or iPad mini rather, up toward the 9.7 inch of the actual original iPad. And that trend, I don't know. A lot of people really like those small size, small form factor stuff. It's like losing the 4-inch iPhone, losing the 7.9-inch iPad mini. I'm not exactly sure how the market is going to react to that, but Apple seems to think that we want bigger displays across the board. We'll have to see if that plays out for them if they do update the iPad mini in 2021. As far as some of Apple's other projects and things that are going on the hardware side of things, Apple's augmented reality, mixed reality glasses, Quo says, don't expect to see those until at least 2022 at the earliest. He says the delay is likely due to costs to actually make the lenses, which would require multiple layers of lamination to create an innovative mixed reality, augmented reality user experience. Although Apple leaker John Prosser thinks that Ming-Chi Kuo's timeline for Apple's glasses might be just a little bit off, he claimed in a tweet that he thinks Apple could reveal them in mid-2021 and also claims to have seen the design, saying that they're, quote, sleek as hell. Another thing, interesting note this week, HomePods seem to be sold out on Apple's website. That's leading to some speculation that we might be getting a HomePod update here pretty soon. We had been talking about and hearing rumors of Apple possibly doing a lower cost version of the HomePod. So maybe we'll get an update to the lineup across the board with an updated higher end and announcement of a new lower end HomePod. Stay tuned on that one. It's not always a sign when things are sold out that Apple is doing an update, but it often is. So that could be happening. And then finally, on the hardware front, there were reports this week that Apple's chip supplier TSMC could announce plans to open a new advanced chip factory in Arizona, according to a report in the Wall Street Journal, and that turned out to be absolutely spot on true. TSMC had been talking to U.S. officials and Apple about opening a U.S. chip factory for some time. It's unclear if they were getting financial incentives from the U.S. or Arizona to build the factory, but they did announce that new plant. They said they plan to produce about 20,000 wafers a month at that facility using their 5-nanometer fabrication process. That's the same specification that is expected to be used for Apple's upcoming A14 processors in the 2020 iPhone, although Apple's chips won't be at that plant because TSMC says they plan to spend about $12 billion building the factory in Arizona and that the first batch of chips from that new facility would not be expected until 2024. As far as when construction will start, they say they'll begin construction in 2021. There's some new rumors about possible new health features in the next generation of Apple Watch. Apple leaker John Prosser says he believes that the next Apple Watch and Watch OS will add some form of mental health capabilities. It's been reported that the Apple Watch Series 6 will likely have a blood oxygen sensor, and Prosser thinks that Apple could leverage that to add detection for when wearers might be experiencing panic attacks. It would do this by combining data from the oxygen levels along with the heart rate sensor to determine if you're hyperventilating. It could then pop up an alert telling you or reminding you to breathe and walk you through Apple's Breathe application and guided exercises to help you calm yourself down. It's also believed that the watch could detect when a wearer is experiencing a high level of stress and also guide you through similar exercises to help calm yourself down. Prosser says he hopes that Apple will announce the new features at this year's Worldwide Developer Conference, although he does hedge his bets and say those announcements could come later. We have had hints for a while that blood oxygen tracking capabilities would be coming to future versions of the Apple Watch, and as a matter of fact, there were references found in leaked versions of iOS 14. It's also expected that the next version of Apple Watch will bring new sleep tracking capabilities. We've talked about those here on the MacCast in the past, and that it would have the ability to measure sleep quality, length of sleep, and other metrics. So, are you excited about the next generation of Apple Watch? I am excited about the potential of a lot of these new features. I have not upgraded my Apple Watch since Series 2, so I'm thinking I'm getting ready for maybe an upgrade. I don't know if these health features are going to be the things that push me over the top. I was intrigued by a number of the things that were added with the Series 4 Apple Watch, and so I'd be curious to get your take. Are you excited about this next generation? Do you think These are kinds of features that Apple needs to be adding to keep their lead in smartwatches, and will you yourself be possibly looking at an upgrade? Curious to get your take? Send your feedback to maccast@gmail.com. And let's close out things this week in the news with a wrap-up of the iPhone 12 and all the things, or at least all the things and rumors that we know so far. This was laid out and wrapped up by Apple leaker, once again, John Prosser. He says there's going to be a total of four models across the 2020 iPhone lineup: an entry-level iPhone 12 and an iPhone 12 Max, two iPhone 12 Pro models, the iPhone 12 Pro and the iPhone 12 Pro Max. For displays, they will all feature OLED displays starting at 5.4 inches for the iPhone 12, 6.1 inches for the iPhone 12 Max, 6.1 inches also for the iPhone 12 Pro model, so a bump up in screen size there, and a bump up on the iPhone 12 Pro Max to 6.7 inches. The Pro model displays will also feature 10-bit color depth and Apple's ProMotion technology. That's the 120Hz refresh rate, giving them the same buttery smooth scrolling as the iPad Pro models. Although Prosser does hedge his bets a little bit on that one, saying that ProMotion could be disabled by Apple, even if it is in the display, depending upon how it impacts battery life. So we've heard this rumor of ProMotion coming to the iPhone and then not coming to the iPhone, and it seems to be tied up in the impact that it might have on the battery life for that device. Obviously, Apple's not going to want to sacrifice battery life just for ProMotion. That could be a little bit frustrating for users, knowing that they have the underlying technology, though it's just disabled, although I would expect the jailbreaking community to address that should that come to be. As far as memory in the new models, 4 GB of RAM in the iPhone 12 models and 6 GB of RAM in the Pro models, 5G support across the lineup, and they're all expected to feature Apple's new A14 chips. I would assume those are going to be A14 Bionic chips. As far as storage goes, 128 GB and 256 GB rather, storage options across all four models, with the Pro models also having a 512 GB option. The iPhone 12 and 12 Max are expected to retain aluminum bodies, and the Pro models will have stainless steel bodies for their construction. We're expected to get dual cameras on the iPhone 12 and iPhone 12 Max, with the Pro models getting the new triple lens camera system with Apple's new LiDAR technology. And pricing, that's expected to be a little bit cheaper on the entry-level models than they were with the iPhone 12 by about $50 US, starting at $649 and $749 for the 128 GB and 256 GB options, respectively. Same thing across the board with the iPhone 12 Max, starting at $749 US and $849 US for the 128 and 256 GB versions, respectively. On the Pro end, it's expected that Apple will have pricing at $999, $1099, and $1299 for the iPhone 12 Pro, and $1099, $1199, and $1399 for the iPhone Pro Max, again for the 128, 256, and 512 GB options, respectively. And with that is the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is Linode. Hey, if you're in the market for a new server, maybe you have a project or a website you need hosted, check out Linode, because Linode allows you to instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in their Linode cloud. You can get a Linode server up and running literally in seconds with your choice of Linux distribution and resources, along with your choice of 10 different node locations. And best of all, they're giving all new MacCast customers a $20 credit. And they offer so much more than just hosting. With Linode, you have all the options and choices to build a server with the services and features that you need. Whatever your requirements, you can build it on Linode. Dedicated CPUs, distributed applications, hosted services, websites, continuous integration, and continuous delivery environments, you can do it all on Linode. And all of their servers feature native SSD storage, a 40 gigabit network, and industry-leading processors. And you can pick from any of their 10 worldwide data centers to set up your server. Pricing is simple with no surprise fees. You pay just for what you use with hourly billing across all of their plans and add-on services. And their new cloud manager features an improved user interface, which makes managing your Linodes and upgrading your plans even easier. It is far and away one of the best control panels I've ever had the pleasure to use. It makes it super easy to configure your servers and your Linodes and set up all of the services and sites that you need. Visit linode.com/mattcast to set up your first Linode and get a $20 credit. That's linode.com, linode.com/mattcast to get your $20 credit and set up your first Linode. And a big thank you to Linode for their support of the MacCast. One topic of conversation that we've been having here on the MacCast for the last couple of episodes is Apple TV Plus and the content that is on Apple TV Plus. I have been enjoying a number of the shows. I haven't had a chance to watch everything that's on there, which is interesting because a lot of people complained that Apple TV Plus just didn't have enough content. I haven't been able to get to all of it, and I think there's many reasons for that. And actually, we're going to hear from a listener here in a second that points out some of those reasons. I've been trying to share the shows that I like. You've been writing in to tell me the kinds of content that you're enjoying on Apple TV Plus, and that conversation has been great. But I also asked for your opinions just on the service in general, and this week I got a great comment from John that kind of points out something that we really haven't addressed yet, and that is Apple TV Plus sort of working in a vacuum? There's a lot of competition out there. There's a lot of choices out there, which is one of those reasons why I haven't gotten to a lot of the content. And John had a little bit different opinion about Apple TV Plus than I had heard from some of our other listeners and comments. So I want to share this with you. Here's what John had to say about where he was feeling he was with Apple TV Plus.
Hey, Adam, this is John from Las Vegas, and I just wanted to respond to you on some of the discussion that you've been having on the MacCast about all the different Apple shows that they've been coming out with. And I had to tell you, I bought a new iPhone 11 Max Pro back in November, and I got the free year with it. And then at work, I got a new iPhone in the end of December, might have been early January, that also came with a free year of it. So I had two options to sign up with the free trial. And I will tell you, I didn't even feel compelled to go in there and look at anything. I have HBO Go, CBS All Access, Hulu, which I get for free with my cell phone plan, Netflix, Amazon Prime, plus whatever I've got on Blu-rays and DVDs around the house. I can't get through season 3 of some of the shows that I'm currently watching on these other services. And the only place in my life that I have ever heard of any of the shows that Apple is making is on your podcast. I listened to another tech podcast where they made an oblique reference one time very briefly. But outside of that, no one is talking to me about this stuff. And I might be an exception in this way, but I just want to point out that if these shows are going to be successful, they have to have shows that people are talking about outside sort of the tech fandom community. And I don't think any of these shows hit it there. I mean, I got to the point where I just got tired of seeing the pop-up reminding me to subscribe and take advantage of my free year. So I went in on both devices, accepted the free year, and immediately canceled. And I know that takes away the free year. And I honestly, I don't even feel bad about it. And I couldn't care less because I have so much other stuff to watch. I don't feel like I'm missing out on anything by not having this. So I know that you probably get a lot of responses from people who are super excited and super into whatever Apple's doing, and I would probably watch some of those shows, but I'm just so overwhelmed with other stuff and other shows that I have on services I already subscribe to. I just have no interest in another one. Even with a year free, it couldn't compel me to even look at it for more than a minute. So anyway, that was my experience. I know other people probably have different experiences, and I appreciate what you do with the show. Thank you so much. Bye.
Hey, John, that is a really interesting perspective, and I think something that we should probably talk about here. And I do somewhat agree with you that not having a buzz going around your show, people not talking about your shows at the water cooler, is somewhat of a problem if you're a new streaming service, right? That's how you get viewers. That's how you get subscribers. That's how you get eyeballs. And I do think that Apple has not had a lot of that. Now, that said, a little bit in their defense, that they did get some nominations for their shows in the award season in their first season of shows, which is great. They've got some really pretty big name stars involved, big name talent and directors, but as we're seeing, that might not be enough. You know, are they, as I posed earlier, are we sort of living in a vacuum? Are they in a vacuum of only sort of the Apple fans? People like myself are the people that are actually watching their shows, and your average Joes, they're not really tuning in. They're not seeing it. You know, is it compelling enough for the masses? And I think that is a really great question and something that, you know, they probably are suffering from a little bit. I don't think timing of when the service came out and sort of what's happening in the world has helped all that much. You would think it would help a little bit more because people might be looking for more content to consume. But as you pointed out, services like Hulu and Netflix and Amazon and a lot of people have access to a lot of services. We have access to more entertainment content probably than ever before. And so picking and choosing becomes a really difficult thing. And if your friends aren't telling you to watch stuff, then you're probably not watching it. And that's maybe one of the reasons why I'm actually talking about it on this show, because I think Apple has some great content in there that people aren't talking about and deserves to be seen. Like, this is talented, well-written, well-produced stuff, and it's getting missed a little bit. The one show that I've been hearing about a lot recently is Defending Jacob. It's getting some buzz, and I think it is getting some word of mouth outside of just the tech industry and Apple. I have not watched it yet. And so I definitely can see where you're coming from. I am a little bit baffled why you wouldn't just keep the free year subscription. Maybe it's just you're worried about it rolling over and forgetting to cancel it, which is always a concern. I think even in canceling it, though, I think it doesn't cancel until you actually reach your 1 year. So it will automatically expire. But I don't think you immediately lose or don't have access to your year. I think once you've signed up, you do have access until that year ends, even if you cancel it. It just means you won't be auto-charged when it comes up for renewal, which is ultimately probably the thing you want. But if you do still have access, I would encourage you to at least take a look at some of the shows, because I think you're missing out on some great TV content. And again, maybe you just don't care, and that's totally fine. I will tell you that Mythic Quest Raven's Banquet was one of my favorites. Just give you guys my favorites. I know I've talked about these a little bit. For All Mankind is excellent. I'm really looking forward to the second season of that show. I did enjoy The Morning Show. That one probably got the most buzz in terms of, I think, awards shows and things like that, and it is really well done. I also really did enjoy Home Before Dark, although it has a little bit more of a kid family-friendly mystery drama feel to it. But if you're looking for something a little bit lighter, something that you can share with your family and doesn't get too heavy, I thought that was pretty good. I also did enjoy the movie The Banker, which I thought was really excellent and has an amazing cast with, you know, Anthony Mackie and Samuel L. Jackson, and well worth a watch. So there's some great content on there. If you can get to it, I would encourage you to check it out. But I totally agree. I mean, Apple is going to have a marketing and a buzz problem. They've been marketing the heck out of this stuff, but it isn't. I don't have people coming up to work saying, hey, have you seen this Apple TV Plus show? And I do think that ultimately is an issue for Apple. Can they work around it? Can they somehow break out of that? I don't really know. Maybe there's this perception that, well, they're a computer company. What are they doing, you know, producing TV content? They're not a network. They're not a Netflix. Amazon seems to have worked through that, but I don't know how long it took for Prime Video to really break out. I think it took a couple years. So it may just be a timing thing. Apple just may need a little bit more time to get that buzz built up, to get enough shows built up and enough content built up to really reach that level. But I'd be curious to know what you think on all of this. Shoot me an email, send me some comments, especially audio comments are welcome. maccast@gmail.com. And speaking of Apple TV, here's a cool little trick that I learned from Josh Centers over at Tidbits. I'll have a link to his really cool article over at maccast.com. But he received a question about, hey, is there a way to actually stream and play your Apple TV content or your Apple TV stuff on your Mac screen? So kind of going backwards, you know, normally we think about airplaying stuff from our Macs to our Apple TVs. The question was, can you go reverse? Can you go from Apple TV to your Mac? And it turns out you sort of can in a little bit of a way. You can play and capture video from your Apple TV screen over Wi-Fi on your Mac using AirPlay. You can do this at least on Mojave or Catalina. I don't know how far back this actually goes. But here's how you would do it. You just open up QuickTime Player and then choose File, New Movie Recording. On Catalina, you'll have to give QuickTime screen recording permissions. But once you've done that, you can click on the arrow, the little down arrow next to the record button, and choose your Apple TV from that menu as the source. Now, the first time you do this, it will connect to your Apple TV. It will display a code that you then need to enter on your Mac. And then also from that same dropdown, you could choose the Apple TV as the microphone source if you also want to be able to record its sound. And then what will happen is you will see the screen, the display from your Apple TV streamed and displayed right there on your Mac. You, of course, can do a recording and record that screen if you want. And you can still use your Siri remote, even if you're in a completely different room with your Mac, because it has the Bluetooth to control the Apple TV. So you can view your Apple TV streamed to your Mac screen. Now, I do think when it comes to recording, there are some restrictions. You might get a pop-up if you try to record content that is copy protected. I think it will actually block it out. You won't be able to record that stuff. But this feature was, I think, originally put in place so that app developers could do screen recording videos of their Apple TV apps to submit to Apple. But we can all benefit from it by being able to stream our Apple TV screens to our Mac displays. I don't know what all of the applications for that are, but I know many of you out there are pretty creative and might find some creative uses for this. So I wanted to share this one with you because I didn't really know this was possible. I also have a bonus tip for those of you who are iPhone 11, iPhone 11 Pro, or iPhone 11 Pro Max owners. This one comes from listener Donna. She pointed out, and I remember seeing this at Apple's keynote, but I had totally forgotten about it. She pointed out that there's a really cool feature in Apple's camera application if you have one of those iPhones, where if you're in the standard photo mode, so like you're set up to take a photo, but you want to quickly take a video instead, you can press and hold on the shutter button and it will start recording video. So rather than having to flip over and swipe over to the video mode on the camera app, you can just press from the photo mode and press and hold on the shutter button and it will record a video. And some of you might now be going, well, wasn't that how you used to take a burst photo? So what if I want to take a burst photo? How do I do that on my iPhone 11, 11 Pro, or 11 Pro Max? Well, in that case, you just press and hold the shutter button and then slide it to the left, and that will put you into burst mode. So that's how you do that on the iPhone 11 Pro, and thank you to Donna for sending that tip in. After 5 years with my trusty 2015 15-inch MacBook Pro, I have to tell you, I now have a new Mac in my life. I just this past week upgraded to a 16-inch MacBook Pro. Now, this wasn't something that I was necessarily planning on doing. We had a little bit of an accident here with one of our older Macs here in the MacCast household. My daughter dropped a bulletin board, a metal bulletin board, onto the screen of her 2011 MacBook Air, cracking it. Interestingly enough, it was cracked under the cover glass, so it looked like just the LCD got a spider crack on it. Probably something that we could have lived with, but you know, I had been waffling and considering an upgrade to a new MacBook and took this as the opportunity to make that happen. It's something that we planned for. You know, I put aside money for the MacCast so that I can have that available when I'm ready to upgrade. And so I took the plunge. I actually went and priced out. I had been considering doing a desktop, maybe going with a 27-inch iMac. But when I kind of priced everything out, everything kind of came out the same. I also looked at the Mac Mini as a possible option. But by the time I added in display and keyboard and all the different specs that I really wanted across all of the models, a few things happened. One, the iMac was backordered until June, so I don't know what that means. That might be a sign that maybe we're due for some new iMacs here pretty soon, maybe around Worldwide Developer Conference. And since I needed a new Mac sooner than that, I decided to go with the 16-inch MacBook Pro, which has been getting some rave reviews, and I was, as you know, before it came out, even particularly excited about. So I was already considering doing this upgrade. This was just the little like push that I needed to push me over the top. And I thought, because I have this new machine, I'd share my experiences with you in sort of upgrading and transitioning and doing that. I will tell you, I had a little bit of a tricky migration and setup, mainly because I didn't have the foresight, and I should know better, I didn't have the foresight to order a Thunderbolt 2 to Thunderbolt 3 adapter along with my machine. So the new machine arrived, I was ready to transfer the information from my 15-inch MacBook Pro, and I knew I wanted to do it through a direct connection, not over the Wi-Fi. More and more lately, I've been using Migration Assistant. I know a lot of people like to use like Carbon Copy Cloner and just clone back their drive, and maybe that's the approach I should have taken, but I've always had good luck over the last few generations of Migration Assistant using that. So that's what I decided to use. I did try to directly connect the two computers together via USB because I did have the adapters for that. So I had a USB-C to USB-A adapter. Tried to go over a USB cable. That did not work. Putting my 15-inch MacBook Pro into target disk mode, it only brought up the ability to connect via Thunderbolt. And so because I didn't have the appropriate Thunderbolt adapter, I couldn't do that. But I did have a clone backup of a USB hard drive. So I tried to go from my USB clone using Migration Assistant, and that worked fine. It recognized the drive, but it went incredibly slow. It took over 13 hours to do the migration. I let it run overnight, and when I got up in the morning, it still wasn't completed. So I had to wait a full like 13 hours for the migration. That was a little bit frustrating, but after that, it worked like a charm. It was beautiful. I had my machine up and running once it booted. I have been going through the process of reauthorizing all my applications, and I do have to say that as much as I appreciate the T2 chip and the security that it brings, and also all of the security that's in Mac OS Catalina, it's really annoying to keep getting pop-ups asking me to go into system preferences, to give permissions to all of my applications, either full disk access or screen recording access or whatever other kinds of access that it needs. It is frustrating. I understand the need for it, but you get a little bit of pop-up overload. And as you know, that can be a problem when it comes to security because you suddenly start agreeing to just everything that pops up in front of you and not really reading it because you just want to get forward with actually getting work done and you keep getting interrupted like that. So that part of the experience hasn't been that great. And hopefully that's something that Apple can address in the future in a secure manner, like that I can transfer, because I had already authorized all those things on my old machine. If they can figure out a way to securely and reliably transfer that in the migration process, that would be kind of nice, I think. But, you know, having to reset that up, that's been a little bit annoying, but really a minor inconvenience in the grand scheme of things. As far as first impressions go, I have to tell you, I do love the screen, the reduced bezels. Having a machine that's basically the same size, if not exactly the same size as my 15-inch MacBook Pro, but with a significantly larger display is great. I have to tell you, the screen resolution is a little bit of a transition. I'm having to bump things up. You know, I am a little bit older, and everything is just a little bit smaller on that screen at that high resolution display level. So that's taking a little bit of an adjustment. I may need some new glasses to overdue for a trip to the optometrist. So that may be playing a factor in that. But the screen is gorgeous. Reduced bezels are really, really nice. The keyboard, I think hands down, is likely the best keyboard that Apple has ever made. The keys are a nice, great size. The travel on them is wonderful. I'm finding I'm having to adapt a little bit just because of spacing and a few other things, but the feel of it is awesome. Touch bar. This is my first Mac with a touch bar. I'm kind of jury out on that for a little bit right now. I'm not really sure how I'm going to feel about it. I do like it. It's a neat little thing, but it does feel a little bit gimmicky. I don't know how much on a day-to-day basis I'm actually going to use it. And that's actually my question for the community, because this being my first Touch Bar Mac, I guess I have two questions. One is, are you using it? And where do you find it useful? And also, are there any tips or tricks? Or did it take a while to transition? Like, maybe I'll eventually start using it more, and maybe it's just because I'm not used to having it there and using it. But so far, I'm not finding myself really reaching up there. And there's been a few little annoyances, things like not being able to just quickly access, say, for example, Expose, or having quick access to a series of function keys. I don't have my function keys anymore, and I mapped those, and I'm used to using those in a certain way. And so I'm going to have to adapt on that level. I also, just things like changing the volume. You know, it was really nice to have just a volume up and down key on the keyboard, and now you kind of have to tap it. And I know you can tap and then slide to adjust the volume, but it's just a different experience. And so I'm transitioning a little bit there, but I think I will get used to that. The one feature that I think is the killer feature of this keyboard that I love having is Touch ID. It's the same transformative experience that I had on my iPhone, going from using a passcode to Touch ID to doing that on the Mac now, you know, not having to plug in passwords, being able to use that for third-party applications and getting access to things. I'm finding that super, super convenient. So I love that feature. I did go with the space gray version after having silver MacBook Pros for years and years and years. And while I love the color, I am noticing that it seems to be a little more apt to pick up smudging. And I'm finding I'm having to like wipe down the metal a little bit more than I ever did with my silver one, which was something I hadn't heard talked about too much and something I hadn't had people mention experiencing, but I'm definitely experiencing that. Again, these are just minor issues because overall the machine is amazing. The performance is amazing. I will tell you, I'm a little bit in dongle town right now because I have a bunch of USB-C to other adapters. So USB-C to Thunderbolt or Thunderbolt 3 to Thunderbolt 2. I've got various adapters that I bought for my iPad Pro that I'm using. So I've got like wires and dongles hanging off everywhere. I think ultimately my plan will be to get some sort of docking solution. I just have to kind of run through those and figure out which one I want to narrow in on. Plus, you know, having spent the amount of money that I spent on this thing, I'm not really apt or jazzed about having to rush out and spend another $300-$400 on a docking solution. I think ultimately that's the place where I want to be, but maybe not ready to quite make that plunge now. So I can live in Dongle Town for a little while, especially given the current state of things in the world. But this thing is awesome so far. I did start hearing about, and a number of people after I tweeted about this pointed me out to the fact that apparently there's some sort of issue with charging. You know, while it has four USB-C Thunderbolt 3 ports, all which are available supposedly to do charging, I'm hearing that if you're going to plug in other peripherals, you want to make sure that you plug in for charging on the right side only. And apparently this is because of some sort of overheating issue that can happen with the processor if you plug in on the left-hand side. And what will happen is Apple, and I think we've talked about this on the show in the past, Apple's systems, if they start to overheat because a runaway application or an application using a lot of CPU processes, what it will do is it will kick in a background process on your Mac, sort of a pseudo process that will grab processor cycles and start to use up the processor on your Mac or the threads on your Mac so that your other application doesn't have access to that. It sort of throttles down your other application's access to the CPU so that the CPU can cool down. And so you'll get this kind of thermal throttling, on the processor. And apparently that happens more readily if you're plugging in other peripherals and charging on the left-hand side. So apparently you have to charge on the right-hand side. Not a big deal, but it does make it a little less convenient. Hopefully that's something that Apple can maybe address in the future. But overall, this MacBook Pro, pretty amazing machine. Absolutely loving it, and it's a nice little upgrade, at least for me. And like I said, that 13-inch MacBook Pro is also getting some great buzz. So if you're in the market for a MacBook Pro, are okay with a little bit smaller screen and maybe looking for some of these newer features, that might be a nice upgrade option for some of you out there. So I'd be curious to get your take, especially those of you who maybe have recently purchased a new MacBook Pro, either 16-inch or 13-inch. What are you thinking about them? What's your thoughts about them? Are you enjoying the upgrade? What's good? What's bad? Shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. And again, if you have any tips for the touch bar, I look forward to receiving those from you as well. All right, let's have a little fun here to close out the MacCast for this week. I have a listener, John, who wrote in, who knew that I am a big fan of tabletop games. I mentioned that as one of the things you could be doing as we're in sort of self-isolation with your family. And he came up with a great question because some of us, you know, might not have people in our families who are into board games. Maybe they don't want to play with us. Maybe you're isolated and you don't have immediate people in your household that you can play with, roommates, and you want to play some of these tabletop games maybe online with friends and family who might be in other locations. And so his question was, you know, a lot of these games, there are versions of them, these tabletop games, physical games, there are versions of them on iOS, and a lot of them are really nice translations of the tabletop board games. And so he said, are there any particular titles that are good for playing with family and friends remotely together online? And a lot of these games I did know have multiplayer modes. A lot of times they just match you up randomly with someone over the internet. So I didn't know which titles would actually be kind of the best ones for playing more in private groups where you can actually invite friends and family to play with you and you know who you're playing with and stuff like that. So luckily, I do have a friend and somebody I've known in podcasting for a long, long time who is very much into tabletop gaming, does tabletop gaming podcast, and also some great charity events around tabletop gaming, Dan Patrice. And I said, you know who's going to know the answer to this question? Dan. He's been on the show in the past. It's been probably a few years since he's been on, but I invited him to come on and talk about these games and share some of his recommendations. And we decided, hey, let's do a series of these because there's a lot of different levels of tabletop games, some more casual, some a little higher end to people who are into really intense gaming. So, hey, if you want just a game that you can pick up quickly and easily with your friends and family, what do those titles look like? What if you're in for a, you know, 2-3 hour gaming experience and you want to go that really high end game level? And then also, what if you need kind of games that work with smaller groups of people? So maybe you can't get 4 people together, but you want to do a 1-player, a solo, or a 2-player game. So we're going to get into all of those over the next couple episodes here on the MatCast. So this week, what we have for you is some of the lighter, more approachable games that are kind of fun for everyone. And then in the coming weeks, we'll get to some of those other titles. But here is Dan with your iOS tabletop game recommendations. Hey, Dan, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, well, thanks for coming on. You are my go-to person for these kinds of questions. So I had a listener who wrote in, and I had mentioned, because I did a segment about, you know, things you can do with your Mac and Apple products mm-hmm. while we're kind of all in isolation, right? So how to pass the time. So we talked about Apple Arcade and Apple TV and a bunch of other stuff. And I mentioned in that board games, that I do board games with my family, tabletop games, and that's an option too, is something you could do. And somebody wrote in and said, hey, so you're into board games. I like board games too. Do you have recommendations of ones that I can play, but with other members of my family who aren't in my house? And I went, well, I play with my family, so they're all here. But that's a right. great question. And I thought, I don't know that, but I know who will know, and that's Dan.
Well, sure. There's a lot of really good, hobby tabletop board gamings, but I'll stick to this little list. I'll stick to 5 really good, kind of lighter to mid-weight family games for the whole family, where you don't really even have to be a heavy gamer to appreciate right. that.
And we're talking about, I don't know if I mentioned, we're talking about like iOS games, right?
Yes, sir.
iPad. These are board games you can get virtually on your iPad to play remote.
I only have one on an honorable mention. I'll throw a few out at the honorable mention at the end. Only one of those is iPad only. Every one of these should be for phone or for the iPad, and I guess, you know, and just any iOS.
Cool.
So number 5, I've got Splendor is available. Now, Splendor is an interesting one that it's been out for a few years, and I've never had any problems. Now, this originally was number 2 or number 1 on my list, but I've seen a lot of reports that it's buggy, but I never had these reports. So since I hadn't played it in a while, and it is still on a lot of people's list of best games, so I wanted to just kind of throw that one out there for people, because Splendor is a very, very light game, very easy to learn. The app is very good because you can play it remotely, and is also really good solo because there's kind of scenarios or a campaign mode you can play. So that is Splendor.
I love Splendor, by the way, on tabletop, although I can't get anybody in my family to play with me. Do you ever have the situation my daughter went had a bad like game when she was really young? We might have introduced mm-hmm. it too early, and now anytime it's brought up, it's like, nope, I don't want to play that one.
You know, it's I had I don't know, I think my son just happened to grok it really early for some reason, like, because yeah. there are games where he's like that, where he just doesn't even want to give it a shot, or he just played it once and didn't like it and won't even give it a shot again. But for whatever reason, Splendor really clicked with him, and you know, and I'm not really a big abstract guy, but it's just one of those fun things, because it has that fun thing where you're trying to get your chips, and then you get discounts to get more, you know, more cards right. into your tableau. So that's what brings it out, where it's just very easy to learn, you know, not real, you know, kind of in mid area to master, but it's just such a great, great, easy game to learn.
Does this one have a good tutorial mode too?
Yes. Excellent cool. tutorial on there as well. I think every game on here, I think, has a pretty good tutorial, or just another thing. There's almost always a how to play video out there, where if you learn the tabletop game, you'll be able to learn here. But almost every game, that's kind of one of those hallmarks of things that they are. It's kind of a must have nowadays, is a good tutorial, because people will rake you over the coals if you don't have a good tutorial.
Yeah. And how's the ability to like find somebody and connect up with them? Because that's, I've noticed, you know, sometimes I'll go find one of these, and it's like, they make it kind of difficult to figure out how to find that specific person you want to play with.
Well, finding the specific person isn't difficult. I think finding people other than a specific perfect person, because Blender's been out for a while, so the community might not be that large to find a random person, but it should be pretty easy to be able to find a friend, or to, you know, once you sign up and to find a friend to play Splendor.
Awesome. And that's what really what we're looking for in this one anyway. It's, you know, like, I want to play with my friend who's across the country, or maybe even just the house next door, right? But you can't physically get together. Cool. All right. Sorry.
That's all right. So number four, I've got Seven Wonders or Seven Wonders Duel. Now, Seven Wonders itself. Now, these are both also these kind of are one of the few ones that hit a couple of different categories. This is really good to play solo because the AI is very good. Or you can play this with other people, where Seven Wonders, you can play up to six. You know, this has a decent community. I would probably play with, four or five. Don't try to get too large of a game. And it's a very simple game where it's just card drafting, Seven Wonders, where you're just drafting certain cards. There's three different ages. Again, it's got a tutorial in there so that you know kind of what the different icons are in the game. And Seven Wonders Duel is the two-player version of Seven Wonders. Both of these games are excellent on a tabletop and excellent on iOS. The implementation are just amazing. And there's a couple of expansions for each one of these that are also available for in-app purchases.
Right. And how is I guess we should also mention how pricing is if you know. If you don't know, that's fine. But generally, I found these games tend to be not too pricey, and they, you know, will have expansions too, like in-app purchase has expansions.
I believe Seven Wonders was $3.99 or $4.99. I should be able to have most of these up as I'm doing them pretty quick. But I think the in-app purchase is either 99 cents or a dollar for the expansion for each one of Seven Wonders. And it's also hard for me to find because I bought them all. So it's hard to find.
I can back you up. I'll get you on that one.
So, and I think Seven Wonders Duel was probably $4.99 or $5.99. Most of these games, the highest that I think I'll mention on any of these would be about $9.99, which is a little pricey for some of the board game ones. But most of the family weight games are very, very cheap, where they're, you know, they max out usually about $3.99 for most of them.
So Seven Wonders is $4.99, and so is Seven Wonders Duel. So,
okay. And I'm pretty sure, like I said, you could probably see the in-app purchases. I think they're either $99 or $1.99 for the expansions as well.
Very reasonable when you consider, you know, tabletop-wise, a lot of these games can go $30, $40, $50 and up.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah, especially Seven Wonders is it's $40 or $50, and Seven Wonders Duel is about $25.
Yeah. So great way to introduce yourself to the game, too, to see if you might want the tabletop version.
Yep. And this, so the next one I've got is a little, I say it's a little heavier, but it's still a very, very light game. It may, you know, on the table, it may look a little intimidating, but it's so easy to learn and such a great game. And it crosses over between regular gamers and RPG players as well. And that's Lords of Waterdeep, which is an excellent worker placement game. And you could play this up to, I believe, five players on the iOS. And also there are expansions as well. This is one of the gold standards. It's been out for a while. It plays so well. And again, it's very easy to find your friends and add your friends onto your friends list and to play with them. An excellent, excellent game with that D&D setting, but it is a worker placement, or what we call like a Euro game and a worker placement game. Excellent game.
Yeah, that's another great one.
Also, we have, so this is kind of the, this normally would be number one if the number one hadn't come out recently, but number two, I have Ticket to Ride. This is kind of one of the greatest gateway games there is nowadays, probably the number one game I try to teach people. If somebody's not sure if they want to learn board games, or they only know mass market games and never really kind of gotten into anything even related to hobby games, but it's really good implementation, and you can play it against the AI, or you can play it against, and this has actually a robust community of people that'll play, and those people are generally really, really good. But if you just want to play it with your family and friends, Ticket to Ride is an amazing option.
Yeah, and it looks like this one's even available in a bundle.
Mm-hmm.
With Ticket to Ride First Journey, which I think is kind of like the kids' version, right?
Could be. I haven't even heard that one. And you can actually find most of these games that I'll mention are almost all in a bundle. They kind of like to throw three or four games together. And this one, I'm not sure who makes that specific one. It's Asmodee Digital. Asmodee Digital is one of the big companies. If you want to do a search for Asmodee Digital, they've got a lot of great games on there. I'll throw in a couple of names of a couple of other companies towards the end if you'd like, and I can that way you can do some search for those. But Ticket to Ride is an excellent game, and you just have to watch, because Ticket to Ride can be as light as it is, it can be really cutthroat. And I hear people who talk about their significant other who's always out there blocking them in every step of the way, and they just can't believe, never seen somebody be so cutthroat.
We have a house rule of not doing that.
Oh, that's good. That's excellent.
Yeah.
And that's a good way to keep keep tables from being flipped, because you know, and it's funny, because we don't necessarily play that way. I think it just kind of happens. I haven't had, you know, as soon as my son gets smart enough where he notices blocking, then I'm like, all right, so here's the house rule: no blocking.
Yeah, no deliberate blocking. You know, we're like, if your route happens to cross that route and you need it, yeah, great, go for it. But you know, no deliberate like going all the way cross country just to thwart somebody.
Yep. And so the number one game that I'd say for families right now, and it is less than a month old, but I cannot believe how good it is Sagrada.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it is an amazing. The tutorial is among the best I've seen. The AI is good to play against. There is also kind of a campaign mode in there, and there's also kind of different challenges you can do. And there's, of course, right now a robust community of people out there playing the game. I had my wife download it, and it's so good, so easy to learn. And if you've ever played the game tabletop, it's very, you know, you'll pick it up obviously right away, and the controls are very easy to learn. It's just not a very hard game to learn, but it's just kind of a good puzzle, and it just feels good playing. I can't recommend it enough. Sagrada is just an amazing
game.
It's
like dice rolling kind of pattern matching thing, yep. Right?
Yes, yeah. And it's based on kind of stained glass. So I think the Sagrada is in, I believe, Spain. It's the cathedral in Spain, and it's just based off of stained glass. So you have these kind of translucent dice that you're rolling, and as you're kind of done, it kind of looks like a nice little stained glass.
Yeah, it's a beautiful game.
Oh, it's and I can't recommend it enough, tabletop as well. But this one, I believe it's $6.99.
Yep.
It is still pretty new, but it is right now probably the best game you can find out there for the family.
4.8 star rating, and it's number 15 in board games. So it's, it's
good. For something released with hardly any bugs, I haven't seen any, and I haven't heard a lot of reports in the board game circles of a lot of bugs on this, but which is kind of really surprising. They've done a really good job on that one as well.
This is a great list of just, as you mentioned, sort of like gateway tabletop games. Like if you're just getting into tabletop gaming, this is a really representative of a pretty broad list of different styles and types. So that's really cool.
Yep. I've got a few others I'll throw out there real quick. So Mystic Veil is kind of, it's not necessarily a hard game, but it's just a little bit different. It's kind of deck building, but kind of not. It's kind of card building. Mystic Veil is a really good implementation on iOS. Small World 2 is iPad only, but Small World is a great old school staple. It's such a great, great game. Catan is also available, which is an excellent implementation as well. And Pandemic is also on the iOS. It's hard. Actually, Pandemic playing, if you're not in the same area, might not be too bad because you don't have anybody to be the alpha player. So it might not be too bad. Or if you just like playing 2 to 3-handed, you could play pass and play yourself and can play it all by yourself. But those four are kind of also ran ones. Right. Companies you can look for. You can look for Asmodee Digital, like we mentioned. Direwolf Digital is another good company. Acrim Digital, Check Games Edition, and Digidiced. And if you really like, a lot of games have app companions. Renegade Games has kind of a companion to their games, which has a solo mode for Clank. WizKids has a kind of a companion. You can also, if you do like kind of your mass market games, you can look for Mattel. It's under Mattel 163 Limited, where you can find Uno and Phase 10. And then Marmalade Games is the one that puts out things like Monopoly, Clue, Life, and Battleship, if you just want to go with the old
classics,
standbys.
Yeah, the classics. Yeah. Cool. Well, that is a great list, Dan. I really appreciate you bringing that to table. And we're actually going to do a couple more of these in the next couple episodes. So this was kind of the, you know, starting out casual ones. I think we're going to get into some more serious stuff and some more fewer player kind of items.
Yeah, in the next some solo episodes. And duo ones.
Cool. You want to real quick just tell people about the stuff you do and where they can find you?
Yep. You can find me at Geek Jock Blog on Twitter. And I do the Geek All-Stars podcast, where it's primarily a board gaming podcast, but we do a lot of geek culture, and we do a lot of kind of, we do some fun little things. Like, we have drafts. We just did the sports uniform draft, where a bunch of us got together and just tried to find out who could draft the best team of all time sports uniforms. So we have a little bit of things like that. So we like to branch out. And you can also find me on TMSPM on Friday afternoons with Scott and Brian.
Cool. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks.
There you go. Dan Patrice and tabletop games that you can play on iOS with your friends and family. John, I hope that helps answer some of your questions. Of course, we're going to keep following up on this in the coming weeks with a few more recommendations. Next time, we're going to get into some of the more serious titles that are maybe targeted more at the seasoned tabletop gamer. And then we'll follow that up, like we said, with some of those one solo and two player kinds of games. Hope you enjoyed that segment. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also PDF Pen for iOS, and Text Expander for iPhone and iPad. You can get more information and details on all of their great software by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the Maccast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the Maccast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or find me on Instagram, just simply MacCast on Instagram. But that will do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.